I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan. I'd like to start with some exciting news. I want you listeners to be the first to know about this. On Tuesday the 14th of July, so if you're listening to this on the day it's going out, that's tomorrow, the team at Sphere and Little Brown and I will be sharing the cover of my debut novel, Insatiable. It's designed by the hugely talented Becky Guyatt. I'm really, really thrilled with it and I've been struggling to keep it to myself. And when I share the cover on social media, I'll also be sharing news about a special edition of Insatiable that will be available exclusively from Waterstones. We'll have some pre-order links in the show notes. If you want to support an author, pre-ordering their books is the very best way that you can do that. And as a reader, I love pre-ordering because it feels as though I'm sending a present to future me. Now, on to this week's guest, the author, broadcaster and book addict Pandora Sykes. Pandora's brand new book, How Do We Know We're Doing It Right, is out this week, and it's a thoughtful, funny, nuanced and beautifully written collection of essays about the way we live, the choices we make and the joy and pain of living through the information overload age. Many of you will know Pandora very well through her work as the co-host of the smash hit podcast The High Low and Pandora's brand new chart-topping podcast Doing It Right. We talked about the economics of happiness, underrated future classics and Jilly Cooper's pubic inventions.
Apparently, if you colour code your books, it's the first sign of being a psychopath.
Oh, what's the second sign?
I don't know, any more signs. I stopped reading at that sign.
Did you put them like this straight away when you moved in, or did you have a few different systems?
Yes, I have colour coded my books for quite a few years. I find it really therapeutic. I love nothing more than getting all my books out and checking that they're still books I want to keep, because if not, they go to the charity shop or they go to friends, and then putting them all back. And actually, I did one weirder thing. I do it quite often when I've got lots of work and I'm feeling stressed, and so I like to distract myself by doing something completely unnecessary and physical. And what I did recently is, some of the shelves are also non-fiction and fiction, so it's like colour-coded. So this is...
Because I was wondering about... I can see, because I saw a big swathe of yellow.
So that's non-fiction, that shelf. These are mainly books I read for the book. So that's like the book research shelves. And then it does slightly fall apart on the yellow shelf. It's mainly fiction, but we have got some non-fiction that snuck in because annoyingly they had yellow covers, so it's not a faultless system, Daisy.
It looks pretty good to me. When you were reading and researching for a book, were there any books that really surprised you or books that you will revisit in the future?
Yeah, quite a lot of them. It was definitely not like I had to do the research and it was of no enjoyment or interest aside from the book. So I discovered the work of a economist called William Davies, who has written a couple of fascinating books, one of which is called How Feelings Took Over the World, Nervous States, How Feelings Took Over the World. And it's all about how we started to make decisions from a point of feeling rather than rationality, which I think is a really interesting one to read at the moment.
Yeah.
And another one in that kind of vein was Against Empathy by Paul Bloom, which is about how, which was something I'd been thinking about for a while, about how empathy maybe isn't the way that we need to be approaching decisions, because empathy requires you to put yourself in someone's shoes, which is kind of impossible and a bit insulting to assume we can shapeshift into everyone's lived experience. And he makes the case for radical compassion instead. So I just found books like that really interesting because they felt like they were written for right now, but they weren't. You know, lots of them were, some of them would be like 20 years old. I read a lot of Happiness Economics, which is bonkers, like sort of the GDP of happiness, or people trying to count the GDP of happiness.
Because I think, you know, I love the idea of knowing more about economics, and for shame, I have tried to read things that can be quite dry, I guess. And, you know, if there's like a paragraph that's a list of numbers, it's awful. I can feel my brain stretching and not quite reaching.
The interesting thing about, I know what you mean, when you hear the word economics, I think that sounds quite terrifying. But happiness economics isn't really economics. It's more trying to look at the ways in which we value happiness, or looking at the kind of industry around it. Like this is, you know, this is another one by William Davies, The Happiness Industry. And the tagline is how the government and big business sold us well-being. So it looks at everything from...
I think I remember that coming out.
Yeah, so it looks at everything from like wellness to the way in which we talk about mental health, or he says the commercialization of our most private feelings, which is obviously social media. That is, you know, we externalize our feelings and then these companies make money off that data. You know, Facebook is being shown to like harvest that information. So it's actually more just quite fascinating. But then I do love nonfiction. Maybe this is not fascinating to everyone. That's okay.
I am very interested, and I love that thread in your book. Sorry, is it all right if I put that there? Do you want to look at a coaster?
Do you know what? I've ruined this. Can you see? That's actually fucking Dolly. Dolly Alderton for you. That is a Dolly Alderton. God knows what that is. A tiny, piddly little bottle she's put there.
But she brings her own wine and puts it on.
She brings so many drinks, yeah.
The thread in your book about social media comes up in so many different ways. And I think that we're so used to, oh, you know, it's only the internet, it's only computers. And it seems really weird to give it as much prominence as we do. But then it is our whole lives. And it's become this weird, I think I talk about this book on the podcast all the time, but I think it came out maybe 10 or 15 years ago, A Super Sad Tree Love Story by Gary Schnettigart, which I've done a horrible job of pronouncing his surname. But it is a... do you know how to say it?
No, oh. I've never heard of that book. It, riveted already.
It's a dystopian novel, which normally I'd be like, oh, no, thank you.
Yes, because I'm a bit no thank
when
you
you're
about
like,
dystopian novels.
Oh, they're on the dusty rocks and they're foraging for food and they've not seen anyone. I had to read Brother in the Land at school and that put me right off the genre. But this is, it's scary because it's got more and more and more true every year. And when I read it, I think Twitter was just starting. I don't think Instagram existed yet. And the way it predicted, the way we just volunteer all of this information about ourselves and what we love and prioritise and care about and what we don't, it's chilling. It's really eerie, but it's very funny as well.
I think I find it quite irritating when people talk about social media as if you're either on it or you're not on it, and therefore if you're not on it, you're not affected by it. But online discourse filters into offline discourse regardless of whether or not you've ever picked up Twitter, because it becomes the way that newspaper headlines are written. It informs the movies that are made, the books that are written, you know, even the way the colour that a cafe is painted, because it might make it more Instagrammable, or the food that they're offering, because they'll have noticed trends online. So the idea that you can be impervious if you don't have an online self is, yeah, I think that's a fallacy. So yeah, it is woven a lot throughout the book, just because I think we have to start seeing ourselves as, you know, it's one whole self. It's not two completely separate selves that you can opt in and out of.
And definitely in terms of the way that I communicate with people and the way I spend my time over, you know, we're just out of lockdown. This is the first live podcast we've recorded since February, I believe.
This is the first thing. Yeah, I think this is the first person I've had in my home. This is Daisy and Dale are. This is the first person. Yes, I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
But thinking about, I suppose, the way I speak to people and who I speak to versus actually being with people. And I have, with varying levels of success, tried to moderate that a bit
over this time to make sure that I wasn't just constantly online and looking for connection and feeling more alienated and looking harder and harder. Like, it's a bit like, you know, when people say, oh, you know, they're lovely, they're just a dick when they're drunk. I'm like, no, they are a dick.
I think we have to... I think they could be lovely and a dick. Maybe that's where we're going wrong, that people have to be lovely or dickheads. Maybe we're all just both.
Thank you, Pandora Zax. We now go to... We contain multitudes. But back to lockdown. What have you been reading for fun?
I was just thinking as I was looking at my bookshelves, I haven't pruned, I haven't weeded out any dangerous, you know, what happens if I have my... No, I won't have my Michael Gove moment. What have I been reading for fun? Well, actually, hold on. Sorry, because these are all the ones that I've read in the last few months. So let me actually just get those out because I can't see them on the shelf.
Oh, I know. I think you just talked about Small Pleasures by Claire Chambers on the high low. I am desperate to read that book. And because we are doing this hourly and listening, I want to say how much I love that cover.
It's a really great cover, isn't it? I'm a bit jealous of that cover. There we go.
Tell me about I Am Not Your Baby Mother by Candice Braithwaite, because I just bought that from the Margate Bookshop. Shout out to the local and...
shout out to the indies. That book is sensational. I ripped through it. And it's billed as a portrait of Black British motherhood, but like all brilliant sort of non-fiction memoirs, it's about so much more. It's about family and... culture, and obviously it's about race, but it's also about classism and the way all those things intersect. And I learned loads from it, but it's also a rattlingly good yarn. Like, she's so engaging, Candice. I loved interviewing her. I just think she's an amazing voice. It's funny because she really didn't want to write that book either. She didn't want to write about motherhood. You know, she only wrote it, she said, because she'd had a few other ideas and they hadn't got off the ground. And of course it's just absolutely brilliant. So yeah, I think you'll love that.
I cannot wait. I wanted to ask you, and this is a hard question, of all the, because on the high low you are just such cheerleaders for books. You've got the nation reading again, but it is so joyous to hear so much enthusiasm, and you know that the breadth of your reading as well. Do you have a favourite of all the books you've talked about on the show?
I can remember that I talked about on the high low and loved Queenie by Candice Carty-Williams, that obviously recently cleared up at the Bookseller Awards.
That book really dazzled me and surprised me. And I started reading it feeling like it's one kind of story. And then there's that kind of switch halfway through. And I really loved, and I found really chilling, but so brilliantly absurd, the way she talks about her job and the way she's treated there. And the sort of, I'm doing making air quotes because it's a podcast and you can't see me, the Black Bridget Jones tag, but how it still seems quite radical to have any woman talking about contemporary life and being single and young and ambitious and trying to make a life for yourself and struggling with so many things, but to be talking about, I suppose, you know, what it's like to do that as a Black woman. I didn't expect to learn as much as I did. I was quite ashamed, I guess, to not know a lot of the things that that are in Queenie, you know, about sort of her experience. And you know, I think I've been naive about certain aspects of dating, certainly.
I think it's a Trojan horse of a book because I think she came quite strategically to it. As someone that worked in publishing, she could see this gap. And I think she wrote it from that place of seeing what was missing. And she writes in a very kind of easy to digest, lively prose. You know, it's not overly complicated. It's not trying to do bells and whistles and all that things.
And but I think it had, because Queenie is so immediate and it is gulpable. And I love that kind of book. And I think, again, this goes back to the dusty dystopian wasteland. It's like someone is looking at a tree for 10 pages. I'm not going to love that, whereas being thrown straight in and hearing someone's voice, and she's got such a singular voice.
And I think as well, just managing to pack in what she packs in, but in a very readable way. It's very, very clever, because at no point do you feel like there's an agenda or the characters are merely being mouthpieces for views or experiences. These are just very convincing people living their lives. But as you say, the amount that you learn and the points of view in the book that are just, I mean, we know it's not in publishing. We know how horrendous the publishing industry has been in terms of diverse voices. So I agree, reading something like that feels, which is mad, radical.
A writer I can see a lot of, who I know that you love, and I love her too, and I would love to chat about her, is Zadie Smith.
Yes, I can see white teeth as I said that to you. I couldn't believe, I was rereading the other day, I can't believe she wrote White Teeth when she was 23.
Sometimes I think about that and I just want to, I don't know.
It's not to, really, isn't it?
I just want to give up and be a welder.
She did, which I did not realise, which I love, she gave herself a shitty review for a can I say that word?
Yes.
She gave herself a shitty review for a magazine I hadn't heard of called like Butterfly or something. And basically she'd had incredible reviews. And then this one review, you know, that said that Smith is like the precocious child always demanding to be like heard singing in the middle of the room. And it was written by this reviewer that no one knew. And it turned out she'd written it about her own book,
which is
ineffably cool. The conviction and confidence that comes with writing willingly, not even just like engaging with, but actually putting together a terrible review about your own book.
Could you imagine doing that? Because now,
nope,
as well,
you
don't have to even wait, do you, to get a magazine to commission you and be in disguise. You can just do it on Amazon.
Control yourself very easily.
And I love that book, The Most Fun We Ever Had by Claire Lombardo, which felt like, in some ways, a really old-fashioned family saga, but with a fairly contemporary setting. Just the detail of it and the slowness of it. And actually, have you read either The Vanishing Half or Silver Sparrow?
I haven't read Silver Sparrow yet, but I loved The Vanishing Half. I haven't got it on my bookshelf right now because I have lent it to my sister. But I have got, oh no, I haven't got The Mothers there either because I've also lent that to a sister. But that I thought her first, The Mothers, should have had much more hoopla around it. I thought it was absolutely brilliant and it really reminded me a lot of my favourite authors, actually. I could see shades of Zadie in it. I could definitely see shades of Meg Wolitzer in it. And
oh, I love Meg Wolitzer.
The Vanishing Half is so, so good. And there was a brilliant New Yorker book review the other day which did what the best book reviews do, where it actually taught me all about the whole kind of literary canon of books about white passing black women. And it looked at how The Vanishing Half had taken and reworked some of those tropes, and then also how she'd added in some of her own, which was so interesting as someone that does not know that genre at all, to see how it fit within and who she was inspired by.
Because the book I really loved about that is Mislaid by Nell Zink, which is kind of the reverse. I wanted to circle way back because I want to know, can you tell me about The Mothers? Because I don't know what that's about.
The Mothers is about it's kind of about the support and galvanising, but also can be destructive community of mothers. It's about group motherhood and the kind of clucking of it, but in a beautiful way because it becomes something communal, but also in a way where, you know, the Chinese whispers and the rumours that are spreading about various children among the mothers. But I think she's an amazing new voice, Britt Bennett. Like, I think she's going to be, or should be, just huge.
I think I read the Vanishing Half and Silver Sparrow, like one after the other. I think I read Silver Sparrow first.
And that came out before An American Marriage, but it wasn't published over here.
Oh,
isn't that crazy?
I don't think I knew that.
Bonkers.
But because they're both about estranged families in different ways, yeah, which is why I thought of those when I saw Claire Lombardo. Because we've both talked about sort of, you know, sisterhood and families and being drawn to those books that are a real celebration of sisterhood, but now being really haunted by these books that are about the weirdness of sisterhood. I have not read the interesting stuff.
Oh, this is so you. This is so you. Yeah, so this is by
Bookshelf of Many Colours.
Isn't that a great cover? Yes, this is by Meg Wolitzer, and I actually think I might have nicked this from my honeymoon. I was in a hotel in Nicaragua, and I think I found this next to the hammock, and I nicked it. And this is, if you like The Most Fun We Ever Had, then you'll love that. The thing I love about The Most Fun We've Ever Had is that I'm sure you have read and enjoyed Such a Fun Age by Kylie
Yes.
Reid. And they were at the Iowa Writers' Workshop together and they thank each other in there.
Oh, that's so
But imagine being, imagine the two of you being like, wow, that, you know, the workshop must be like, that was a good year, that was a good crop. I haven't got, Such a Funny Age isn't here either, because I must have lent that out. Oh, I need to start keeping my library ticket system again.
I did love that book, though. I love the funniness of it and the way it just skewers that influencer culture so delicately. You know, in someone else's hands, it would have been really clunky and clumsy and awful, but it was just the lightest touch.
It is the lightest touch, and it's also not just, it's not just about one thing.
Well, what I really want, I don't know, Kylie Reid, if you're listening, right at the beginning, it talks about how Amir is from a family where everyone is very kind of purposeful and everyone's got hobbies and passions, and she doesn't have that. And I want to read that book about her growing up in that family.
I tell you what I've just seen that I have read in the last year, and actually we've got her coming on the high-low soon, is We Need New Stories by Nesreen Malik, who's a Guardian columnist. And that is all about, that's probably one of the most important non-fiction books I've ever read. And it is all about the myths that we fall into thinking and upholding in society. And it so elegantly dismantles everything you thought you knew about or how a capitalist society should run. It's an absolute stick of dynamite, this one. I can't recommend that enough.
That sounds great. So that's coming in September.
So, no, that came out last year, but it's September. About to come out in paperback.
Ah, brilliant.
In a couple of weeks, yeah.
I need to sort of ask about books that I don't recognise and want to know more about, but I have just seen Beautiful Ruins, which I remember reading that a few summers ago and just thinking, this is the ultimate summer holiday book.
Such a good title, that.
I loved that edition as well. I've seen a few, but that's the one I had where it's got this sort of... You see, you could add a pinch, put that on your... on this shelf with the many different colours.
Yes. Yes, interesting. I thank you for your feedback. I'll consider it. Yes,
sorry,
I agree.
I'm not here for that.
Don't worry, I'm not that precious about it. Yes, this is such a lovely cover. I think it makes it look like a real old timer of a book, doesn't it? Literally looks like a Penguin one from like the 90s.
I was going to say, you know how they say don't judge books by their covers? I think if I'd seen the other version of it, I probably wouldn't have been as drawn to that as I was.
I read it when I was on holiday in Italy, and it's set on an Italian island in the 60s. So that is... it's always nice to accidentally read a book where it's set, unless, of course, you're just sitting in your house in London reading a book about in a house in London, then it's probably a bit less of a thrill.
You've got NW by Zadie Smith. That's that experience if you want to have a staycation read. I love Mary Gatesville and I've not read Lost Cat. Is that short stories or is that a novel?
No, this is coming out in November. That's a proof. And there's a lot of stuff that I think is going to blow people's mind in there. It's ostensibly about her lost cat, but it's about a lot more than that. But I do love Bad Behaviour.
Is it like a continuous story or is it kind of...
It's her first non-fiction.
Ah!
It's about her young cat, Gattino, who goes missing. And she weaves in losing him with... all sorts of experiences in her life, namely the fostering of two teenagers.
Because I loved her, and I think I found her when I was a teenager, and it was just so dark and distressing and passionate and upsetting, and that sort of, I had that emo, like, oh, she's the writer for me. And I think if I had come upon her at a different time in my life, I might have been like, oh, that's a lot.
But I wish I'd discovered her as a teenager. I didn't discover her until 2 years ago when I read Bad Behaviour. And I've since bought Veronica, which is another one of hers, isn't it? And One Girl Fat, One Thin, which always strikes me as a title that probably wouldn't be made now.
I think that must be why, because I was probably about 12 or 13 and reading a lot of terrible, terrible YA books that were essentially guides to having eating disorders that were, you know, called things like... A Hope for Jenny. It had like a sort of very pale girl on the cover looking sad. Two Girls, One Fat, One Thin sounded like more kind of bulimia porn for me. And it was that, but it was so much more. It was one of those books that I read and thought, I didn't know you were allowed to do that.
Yes, there is an element of that with Mary Gatesville, isn't there? Which is always a reminder that you are, this idea that you don't have choices in what you write about is ridiculous. That's your own imposed rules, isn't it? She shows that if you want to rip out the rule book, rip it up.
Well, I suppose that it's one thing to have that audacity and another to find a publisher who wants to encourage and promote that audacity.
Yeah, true.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Pandora soon, but now I want to tell you about a book I adored and I think you will too. Silver Sparrow by Tiara Jones, who won the Women's Prize for Fiction for her novel An American Marriage. Silver Sparrow is the story of two sisters, Dana, who knows all about the other daughter of her bigamous father, and Charisse, who embarks upon a complicated friendship with Dana, unaware of their biological connection. It's set in Atlanta over the 70s and 80s, and it's a gripping, dazzling and immersive exploration of race, class and family. Dana and Charisse are so vividly drawn. Jones is a stunningly gifted writer who creates characters that feel as real as your family. I've thought about Dana and Charisse every day, and as soon as I finish the book, I miss them. Silver Sparrow is published by One World and out now. Now, back to Pandora. Oh, God, a writer who I feel ashamed of not reading, and I know I'd love her. Every time I see her on a shelf, I feel a twinge of not having got to her yet, is Deborah Levy.
So that's my shelf of what I'm going to read next. It's my, like, to-do list shelf. And there's actually a few more next to my bedside table. I have read half of The Cost of Living. It is quite short and very thoughtful and deeply personal. And I don't know why I didn't read the other half. I think I must have had to abandon it when I had to read lots of non-fiction for work. But it's on the to-do list to return to.
Do you find that when you're writing, there are certain writers you can't read because you feel yourself adopting their voice, or do you just read and read and read?
No, I don't feel that so much. No, I suppose the only kind of strategic decision I've made with reading is that I've been trying to read more fiction recently because I've read so much non-fiction in the last year, and I feel like I've been missing out on some really good fiction. But no, I don't worry about taking on someone else's voice. I don't think I'd know how to do that, to write like someone else.
Because I think a lot about the rhythm of it. I still think about when we had Nina Stibbe on the podcast talking about her letters home to her sister and that she'd forgotten that they all read Adrian Mole and, like, you know, and MK and the boys were, and they all started leaving very, like, moley notes to each other. And there's a good sort of couple of months, I think, when she's writing to her sister and she's like, oh, this is clearly me trying to be Adrian Mole.
That's so funny. I imagine you do that quite a lot when you're younger. I probably did when I was younger. I do remember that I was obsessed with America for a while and insisted on, like, writing to my mum, you know, putting an O in her name, and writing just really weird, cheesy stuff to my older sister, like, you know, hope you have a lovely day now. So I think I was more taking on weird stuff I'd watched on my friend's Sky TV, because obviously we did not have Sky as a teenager.
It's weird how, because I remember that thinking anything American was hugely aspirational. And I also remember going to friends' houses who had Sky and being quite casual and, like, oh, maybe we should just watch TV. And they're like, no, let's play, let's do something. Oh, because we had
the four channels. Twins, and they did so many shows on, like, Nickelodeon. Oh, God, I feel, honestly, just thinking about it and getting, like, a sort of bloom of joy in my chest. That really was the best thing in the world, being able to watch the Olsen Twins on Sky.
Do you have any favourite America books? Because I was thinking as well how now the idea of, you know, dreaming of American ways and American life, but oh, no, thank you.
I read tons of books by American authors, actually. I mean, Claire Lombardo, who we're talking about as American, Kylie Reid.
Daisy Jones on your shelf.
And that, anything set in and around California and Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s, that would be, if I could order people to write books for me, that would be my premise.
Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of Halle Butler is American and Natessa Moshberg.
But when you were growing up, was there anything where you're like, oh my God, this is the America I want to live in?
No, actually, I don't think I read much American.
You didn't have a Sweet Valley phase.
I remember reading Prep by Curtis Sittenfeld when I was at university, and I was fascinated by that.
Because the genius of Prep, I think, is it's so good, but also it's so good for English kids who yearn for that life, because Lee is this outsider who's observing, as we would be, and that sort of the carelessness of them and their, I don't know, you know, everything they take for granted and that level of privilege. And I do think that's something that's a bit different in this country in terms of the way people live. I get the impression, I could be wrong about this, that British people are conditioned to put up with a certain level of scruffiness and things being inconvenient that a surprisingly large minority of Americans just wouldn't do.
Definitely, because they were kind of moving towards that friction-free, seamless life much earlier than us. We've always had that kind of progress secondary, haven't we? Although it almost feels like we're on, because I suppose globalisation now almost feels like we're on a level playing field. It used to be, I remember when fruit roll-ups came to the UK and I felt like I'd been waiting 10 years for a fruit roll-up, and it was like, it was always all like Reese's Pieces.
Mm.
Now, of course, you can get them in every newsagent, but they were really hard to find.
But no longer does anyone come back from America like, oh my God, you have brought me Levi's and Jolly Ranchers.
Swedish fish, still quite hard to find. In a very large Sainsbury's, you might.
There is a book about America. Well, it's about lots of things, and I loved it so much, and I don't know if you've read it, but if you haven't, I think you'd adore it. The Luckiest Girl Alive by Jessica Knoll, which I think I talk about on the podcast all the time. And it was sort of marketed as a thriller. And again,
can't wait to read
based
it.
On the cover, I would have thought, not for me, no thank you. Yeah. But it's about a girl at prep school and sort of briefly falling in with the popular kids, and something awful happens and she is shunned and kind of, you know, shuns herself. But then years and years and years later, she's working at a magazine. She's got this very glossy life and this perfect fiancé. I'm making air quotes again. He's a disaster and a monster, and she is just trying so hard to be perfect and polished and make sure the past doesn't catch up with her. And I think the observations about class are really subtle, and anyone who says that America is a class society, it's like, that's not true at all.
I used to love thrillers when I was younger, or at least I thought I loved them, and then I realised that I was always going to the last page of the book because I wanted to know what happened. And so I don't actually enjoy reading a thriller now, because I know there's a big reveal at the end and all I'm doing is counting down the pages until I get there. It's really not a type of book that makes me feel good.
I do think that more often than not, the people who, and then partly it's jealousy, because I could now struggle with plot and just, you know, I love dreaming up people and then having them do interesting things that are both make sense as things that they would do, but are also surprising enough to make it worth reading the book. I'm like, oh, that is hard. You'll enjoy my upcoming novel, listeners. But I think that there are lots of thrillers that are written by people who are much more passionate about what is happening than who it happens to, which is fine. That's the kind of book that people love. And I like the opposite thing. I'd rather have characters that I can really feel, and they can just be in a room for 300 pages.
But I think that's why we both love A Love Story for Bewildered Girls.
I loved that book.
There is.
I felt like that did not get the love it deserved.
No, it didn't. Oh, here she is. She won, I think, one of Penguin's writer schemes. You know, they do, like, she was a young,
Emma Morgan.
Yeah, the Right Now. She was part of the first intake of mentees for the Penguin Random House Right Now scheme, which aims to seek out, mentor and publish new writers from communities underrepresented on the nation's bookshelves. This is a finished copy, so I think I've lent my proof out, but I compared it to A Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing. She then wrote to me and said, that's one of my favourite books. So I'm, you know, glad that you picked up on that. But it did really remind me. And actually, and speaking of A Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, this one, which again did not get anything like the pickup, it should have came out ages ago, The Wonder Spot.
By Melissa Bank. That is a loved looking copy.
So I got it off eBay. I try and buy, unless they're new, I buy my books off eBay. And she wrote A Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing. And The Wonder Spot is, it's just the most brilliant buildings roman. Like, if you like...
You love a buildings roman.
I mean, I did my dissertation on them at university, for God's sake. Ridiculous. I've got books coming out my ears now, haven't I? I'll just put those there.
Oh, because I've not actually read A Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, a little bit like Deborah Little. I know I will like that. I know I'll read it.
You will.
It does just feel sometimes like everywhere I get books totally. In my face.
I know. And it's such an honour receiving proofs of books. And I've had to do something that feels very counter to my yearnings and say, I just can't have any more proofs at the moment because I'm just not reading, you know, look at that shelf. I'm so excited to read the shelf. So I just need... I need to catch up before I let any more books over the threshold.
That is something I did in lockdown that felt really indulgent and just lovely. It was rather than feel that, oh my God, I've got to read these, you know, 900 hot books for autumn. I'm just going to read some of the things I've always wanted to read and never got to.
Like this. Like this has been on my shelf for 2 years.
A Ladder to the Sky by John Boyd. Again, great cover.
So his most famous one is
Is Invisible Fury.
That's exactly it, yeah. And that is next on my read list. He's got a brand new one out as well.
Ooh. That was as though it was on like House of Games or something. And I'm like, I know the answer to that. I'm like, no, it's not a quiz. It's not points. So what's this about?
That is about, not to make you feel pressure, but you will also love that. That is about a young writer who essentially cannibalises other people's stories. So he seduces, not always romantically, older writers and or other writers and steals their books.
I'm getting big Townsend Mr. Ripley vibes here.
It is, but it's not, again, like you say, it's not a thriller. I mean, there's a thrilly element to it, but it's more just like a psychological, it's very funny as well.
Oh, great. Yeah, oh, I must read that. I can't wait. I'm delighted to see you have a copy of Polo by Jilly Cooper.
That's where, Jilly Cooper is how I learned about sex. I was a very precocious reader and I read her books when I was 11 and I didn't know what most of the words meant. I didn't know what either of the C words meant and I didn't have Google at the time and no one would tell me what they meant. My mum just said she didn't know.
What's the other C word?
Come.
Oh.
Come and cunt. No, I guess I must have known what that was. But I did not understand all this talking of coming and going. And
also, she's a fiend for, I think, 69ing. It's always like a soixante-neuf is the trademark of a.
And she did.
Expert
and
lover.
My only major criticism, I mean, obviously they are farcical and escapist and ridiculous, but my only major criticism is that she made me believe that blonde women have blonde pubes. And I later found out that you cannot have blonde pubic hair.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I mean, I've never
seen any, but...
Maybe I should Google that. I'm pretty sure you can't. Hold on, let's have a look. Can you get blonde pubic hair? Oh, yeah.
A high amount of eumelanin, with little pheomelanin, results in black or brown hair. It's the ratio of eumelanin. Oh, God.
To be fair, look, I'm not finding what I want on Google, but I remember asking two very naturally blonde friends and they said they did not have blonde pubic hair. So that is the extent of my research. So I feel like she's lying about that.
We could go to Sweden and make a documentary about this. Is it in... No, it's in... I think it's in Riders, where American Helen sprays herself with feminine hygiene spray and Rupert's really upset about it. Rupert Campbell-Black, the handsomest man in England with a cock like the post office tower. But I think she's used hairspray by accident. But that whole, like, I didn't know that hygiene spray was a thing that people used.
Thinking about Helen and Rupert makes me feel anxious because she was so jittery and nervous and quite cruel, especially to her children. And Rupert was so cruel to her. So just thinking about their relationship, it makes me feel like panicky for them.
Well, I was just thinking about how Janie Lloyd Fox was a proto cool girl, and it was something I loved to read and still think about often. But when I was impressionable and that sort of, oh, you need to be, you know, more like Janie and just be like very...
Janie was a bitch. She wasn't she?
Oh, God, and she gets so much worse in the later books.
Yeah.
Is it in...
My favourites are her earlier books, though.
Definitely. There is one... I don't want to upset you if you haven't read it, but there's someone in those books I love very much who dies, and Janie is just dreadful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. I know.
But I think because she is so politically incorrect, I sort of feel much more comfortable where she... It's a consistent universe, whereas I think later, and, you know, I love Julie Beyond Your Sense, but when she's sort of trying to be...
Oh my God, when the boarding school and the state school all make best friends and all start going out with each other. Yeah, it doesn't really work, does it? But again, it's escapist. It's, I don't, you know, I don't need Jilly Cooper to be the most factual,
no,
culturally progressive. She's in her late 70s now, like, you know, I think we have to do an element of letting books exist in their time. That doesn't mean that they should be written like that now. And that doesn't even mean that reading them might be really unpleasant for some people. You know, I think you have to consider your own needs and anxieties when you pick up a book. And if it's just going to upset you or...
Well, you can say the same about Jane Austen, can't you? That she is... genius, but she is writing about a world, and there is, and also
a long time ago. I don't know if I've got any Jane Austen on my shelves. Have I? I can't say. I read. Do you know what? It's that thing, same as like William Faulkner. I had to read her at school, and then so I've never been curious to revisit her.
What did you have to read at school? Can you remember what the
Pride and Prejudice?
I love it, but that book comes with a lot of baggage.
Same with Wuthering Heights. Like I can't, having studied it.
The best way to make anyone read a book, well, I think that's why I loved Mary Gates Girl so much, because it felt so forbidden. And anything that, because it's so intimate reading, and anything that feels like it's for you and just for you. And being one of 20 kids having to read Pride and Prejudice and being told, she's the greatest satirist of the age. Satirist. But yeah, it just kills all that is good about reading. But I did see on the other shelf a book that I love, and I loved it for that reason, that it felt forbidden, but I have a feeling that you did not like it, which is Valley of the Dolls.
I think I did like it. No, I think I did like it. Did I say I didn't like it? Oh, I found it really depressing. Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly a... It's not a happy ending, is there?
No. I suppose I kind of...
I found it really depressing, actually. I feel depressed even talking about it.
Oh, God.
Sorry. I think it's good. No, I'm joking. I think it's good, though. I don't think that's a reason not to read it.
I mean, I do think that's kind of a Trojan horse book as well. And again, I think it's really interesting in the context of when it was written, where it now it feels, I think, almost tame in places, but that it was deliberately written to be quite grubby and scandalous and sensational. But then you've got a lot of kind of... It reminds me a bit of, I want to say The Room by Mary McCarthy, but I might be wrong. But I'm sure that as a sort of... It was an early three women, but about four women, but just about a very sort of simple, very wealthy, privileged white women going around in the 60s and 70s at a time of great social change.
I think the reason why I found it so depressing is obviously like the women are just treated so appallingly by the men. But the thing that I think is most fascinating about it was the deep dive into, you know, pill culture. And also obviously at that time, a lot of them took uppers as a diet pill because they had speed in them. And I found it interesting the same way that I found Betty Friedan's, what's it called? The Feminine
Mystique.
Feminine Mystique, exactly. That book was, I found, incredibly formative, actually, especially when I was writing my book, because a lot of the things in The Feminine Mystique are things that I think women are struggling with now, which is kind of how womanhood is seen and how it can be flattening. And that, you know, she said that she defined kind of womanhood in the 60s as the boil that would not burst. And I think when you read Valley of the Dolls, you get that similar feeling that, like, womanhood is sort of... Well, it's suffering in Valley of the Dolls, isn't it? You feel really sorry for the women.
They are the ones who are sort of providing absolutely everything. Oh, God, that's a really great book that I've just read. I don't know if you read it. The Girl with the Louding Voice by Abby Daray.
No, it's on my... Oh, it must be... If it's not there, it's next to my bed. Be next to my bed.
Oh, Pandora. So you've got this... the heroine, Adini. I don't know when I last read a book where I just fell in love with the protagonist so hard. You know, even women who are outwardly powerful
as well.
Did you? Swan Song.
So, which is obviously about Truman Capote and his kind of society swans, these five women he was best friends with.
Yes.
And that was actually edited by my editor for my book, and she these kind of society women who have everything, like Lee Radziwill, everything at their feet, and you know, they look incredibly beautiful and they're very rich, but they are treated pretty shabbily by the men in their lives, including Truman, you know, including their best friend, because he writes a book about them, or that got turned into kind of a series of long form articles for GQ, and it's based on a true story, obviously, so there's a lot when you're reading it, you're like, how much of this is true, because Truman Capote comes across awfully, you know, as a man that they all trusted, and his loyalty is flip in an instant, and they're all just, you know, everything is copy for him.
Well, I guess it's like In Cold Blood, isn't it?
That is a great book.
That is a short story of his that I adore. I don't know if it ever came out kind of as a novella, but it's, I think it's called A Christmas Memory, and it's about, and I think it must be quite autobiographical, and it's him as a very young boy with his grandmother, who I think maybe had Alzheimer's or something, but she was treated by the family like a child and behaved like a child, and she was his playmate, and they were sort of each other's like closest confidants, and it's about them preparing for Christmas together, and it's a story of just such shattering, devastating sweetness and love and honesty, and it's so pure, and then at the end it's heartbreaking because I think she gets put in a home and he gets sent off to military academy.
Look, I know, you're tearing up talking about it,
but it's so sad, and I suppose perhaps that's why, if it that was part of his life, that you would go through something like that and you would become bitter and horrible and cruel and a venal journalist. But to know that a writer is capable of something of that depth of feeling. I'm going to say, of the books on that shelf, other than the ones we've talked about, what are you excited? If I could give you a week off and, you know, 9 to 5, you can, you don't have to worry about childcare or anything else, and you can just sit down with a book, what are you going to sit down with?
I am really excited to read Brown Baby by Nikesh Shukla, which is out in February.
February 2021.
He has edited several anthologies already. The Good Immigrant, which was for over here, and then The Good Immigrant USA, which was American writers. And yeah, I'm a big fan of him, and that's obviously quite a personal book for him, so I'm really excited about that one.
What was his novel called? The one he wrote, Destiny, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, this is, so it says on the back, a love letter to the author's mother who passed away just before his eldest daughter was born. Oh, that sounds totally delicious. A memoir of race, family and home.
Not unlike Rick Samada, I Never Said I Loved You, which is a book I loved. I think I read it on holiday and there was lots of hooting and then crying on the sun lounger.
There's so much in that book. It's hilarious and devastating, isn't it? And it's also so original. It's kind of quite a bonkers book. My favourite bits are actually when he was writing about his relationships with women that are obviously very creative and passionate and kind, but also like kooky, you know? They're different. Like, he obviously likes really creative women that don't fit into a mould, and it was a joy to read about women like that.
Yes, I like those bits in the way that I like or love the book and the films of Noah Baumbach.
Like, you know, he moves into his girlfriend Lily's house and she puts she hangs these cocoons everywhere, which at some point turn into really large insects that just live in his bedroom.
There is the bit that I think about all the time, and I think it's quite near the end and I can't see it, when he's on the plane and he's trying to reassure those nervous women next to them, where, and he's trying to say the plane is okay to them, and he said, the plane is suffer.
That's a very lovely memoir, that.
I wanted to ask, and this is a really mean question, because you have just written a brilliant non-fiction book that I adored, but are you going to write fiction? Are you thinking about it?
Oh, I'm not thinking about anything beyond week by week or even day by day at the moment. I feel like if hopefully that's the legacy from the pandemic, or certainly I'd like it to be for me, is to just be a bit more present in the work I'm doing rather than thinking what's next. I definitely do not have another book in me right now. I think I need to let this one come out and see how it does first.
How are you feeling about that?
Yeah, nervous. Nervous, but apparently that's normal. Definitely pretty worried, but I think, you know, I did the best job I could on it, so I think I just have to hold on to that, and then, you know, you put it out in the world and let it do its thing.
I do think the nice thing about books, if you come from journalism and you're used to producing things that people react to quite quickly, is that I think people, there's more of a generosity with books, maybe, that people do have time to really let things percolate, and it's more of a, I don't know, there's a willingness for the reader to come in and be with you. So I think it's weird. I don't know how you'll find it. I think it's different for every writer, but I found it slower but sweeter, I guess.
Oh, that's nice. I'd be up for slower but sweeter. That's going to be my tagline for 2021. Slower but sweeter.
Oh, I like that.
Huge thanks to Pandora. How Do We Know We're Doing It Right? It's published by Cornerstone. It's out on Thursday, the 16th of July. I love it. And if you like Zadie Smith and Gia Tolentino, you'll love it too. It's a breath of thoughtful, fresh air in a world of frenzied shouting. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at YBooked. I'll see you next time, but for now, I leave you with this from Muriel Spark. It never really occurred to her that literary men, if they like women at all, do not want literary women, but girls.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.